This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Hello, I'm Alan Stanford, and welcome to Macbeth in Monaghan.
When shall we free meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain?
Go, get him, Sir Dilemma!
God save the king!
The victory fell on us!
Hooray!
What he had lost, noble Macbeth had won!
Look! What I have, show me, show me!
Hark!
Speak!
Macbeth!
Macbeth!
Hark!
That shall be king hereafter!
Stay! You imperfect speakers, tell me more!
Beware the thing of the fight!
What? Can the devil speak true?
Oh. Look to the lady!
Come, you spirits!
Duncan comes here tonight.
Thanks.
Bring forth men, children. This is a sorry sight.
Macbeth does murder sleep. Macbeth shall sleep no more.
A little water clears us of this deed.
Wake, Duncan, with thy knocking! I want that corpse!
Horror! Horror!
To make them kings, the seed of Banquo kings! Which of you have done this?
Murder and treason!
Hello and welcome again to St. Louis Secondary School, Carrick Macross in County Monaghan, for the third of our programmes, Macbeth in Monaghan. And we'd like to welcome four other participating schools, Monaghan Collegiate School, Patrician High School, St. McCartan's College and Inver College. Now today we're going to be dealing with the next cycle of the play. We've already examined the three opening cycles, which are the prophecy, the murder and the betrayal. Macbeth, having been prophesied he will become king, becomes king by assassinating his predecessor Duncan. He's gained power, he's got everything that the witches seem to have promised him, but he's got a worry, and that is that he will not be able to pass it on to his own children. He will have none. That the line will go to Banquo, his friend. Macbeth tries to sidestep this prophecy. He decides he won't let that happen, and he plans it by murdering his friend Banquo. That's the great act of betrayal. He murders his friend in order to change the future. But he fails because Banquo's son Fleance escapes. Macbeth now realizes that all he's got is himself. He'll be king for as long as he remains king. There is no future. There's no line of succession. He realizes that the witches, even though they told him the truth, didn't tell him the whole truth. So he wants to know more. He decides to go back to them and find out what the future really holds. The fact of it is that Macbeth is beginning to lose his reason. The power that he's got, and the fact that he has basically been sleepless since the murder of Duncan. And he's also now being haunted by the ghost of Banquo, is tipping his reason over the edge. He needs to know, not just that he will survive, but how he will survive. So he decides to return to the source of the prophecy, the Weird Sisters.
Round about the cauldron go, in the poisoned entrails throw.
Toad that under cold stone days and nights has 31.
Sweltered venom sleeping got, by life first in the charmed pot.
Double toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble.
Fillet of a fenny snake, in the cauldron boil and bake.
Eye of newton, toe of frog, wool of bat and tongue of dog.
Double toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble.
Shakespeare's audience would have believed in witches, would have accepted the very idea of witches. They would have been afraid of them. So by playing out this scene, by having the witches put the ingredients into the cauldron, a fillet of a fenny snake, eye of newton, toe of frog, they're all fairly disgusting things. But the audience, Shakespeare's audience, would have accepted this scene as being a reflection of what really goes on when witches gather together. He's setting up something that is to the audience's mind, very, very frightening. And for The Frightening Witches, I'd like to thank Amy Boyd, Esther Condell, and Alison Dudgeon, all from Collegiate. Thank you. The witches, by their invocation, have summoned up a new character for Macbeth to meet. This is the character of Hecate. She represents the link to the demons. She represents the link to true prophecy. And she also has a very important thing to say about Macbeth's nature, in fact, the nature of most human beings.
He shall spurn fate, scorn death, and bear. He hopes above wisdom, grace, and fear. And you all know security is mortal's chiefest enemy.
Security is mortal's chiefest enemy. What Hecate is saying to the witches is to catch him, to damn him, we make him feel safe. Because once he feels safe, he will do anything he wants, and that's what's going to destroy him. He'll lose the run of himself once he feels that he's completely safe. And it's by that misleading prophecy, a prophecy that always tells the truth, Macbeth will be drawn to his doom, to his destruction. Hecate, in a sense, represents an even greater power than the witches themselves, a power that the witches must be obedient to, the power of evil. Macbeth also recognizes the power of Hecate. He's very, very ready to summon up, to conjure up evil.
I conjure you by that which you profess. However you come to know it, answer me. Though you untie the winds and let them fight against the churches, though yesty waves confound and swallow navigation up, the bladed corn be lodged and trees blown down, the castles topple on their warders' heads, though palaces and pyramids do slope their heads to the foundations, though the treasure of nature's germens tumble altogether, even till destruction sicken, answer me to what I ask you.
He's actually condemning everything for the sake of his own need to know. He's saying, though the winds knock down the churches and the waves swallow everything up, I don't care. We'll have thunder, famine, we'll have storms, we'll have tempest. Nothing matters except what I want to know. He's really in the mood for summoning something serious. And thank you to Sarah Woods for Hecate and Willa van Niekerk, both from Collegiate.
My name's David McWilliams. I'm going to give you my take on what I think is the most interesting part of Macbeth, and it is ambition. But it's not the ambition of Macbeth himself, which is there. It is the convulsive ambition of Lady Macbeth. This is a woman who will do anything and corrupt anyone to get the prize, to push her man up the ladder. For example, if you were to put Lady Macbeth now and Macbeth himself in the context of modern Ireland, she would be a pushy, ambitious, insufferable yummy mummy driving an SUV, pushing this poor but ultimately decent chap up the corporate ladder. She wants him on the bullet train straight to the K Club, no stopping, and she wants him to be the CEO of a publicly quoted company with share options by 2008. And he, on the other hand, is a pretty clubbable, decent, probably UCD commerce graduate from the late 80s or early 90s, has a bunch of mates, is quite happy to be the chief financial officer, doesn't particularly want the big prize, but she's having none of it. She wants the tiled kitchen, she wants the second house, she wants a detached residence, not a house, in Cowper Road, that's for starters, and then she wants the chief executive prize. And he, God bless him, has to deal with that. So the biggest difficulty in Macbeth's life isn't Banquo or Duncan or anybody around him. It's his missus.
So having summoned up the demons come to tell him the truth. And remember, it's very important to realize that everything they tell him is the truth. But Macbeth only hears what he wants to hear. What they tell him is true, but what he hears is the parts of it that are to his advantage.
Macbeth, 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 beware Macduff, beware the Thane of Fife, dismiss me, enough.
Whate'er thou art, for thy good caution thanks, thou hast harped my fear aright, but one word more.
He will not be commanded. Here's another, more potent than the first.
Macbeth, 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 be bloody, bold, and resolute.
Laugh to scorn the power of man, for none of woman born shall harm Macbeth.
Then live, Macduff, what need I fear of thee? But yet I'll make assurance double sure, and take a bond of fate, thou shalt not live, that I may tell a pale-hearted fear it lays, and sleep in spite of thunder. What is this that rises like the issue of a king?
Listen, listen, listen.
Be lion-mettled, proud, and take no care, who chaffs, who frets, or where conspires are. Macbeth shall never vanquished be until great Birnam Wood, to High Dunsinane Hill, shall come against him.
And so the witches have told him the future. They have said that he should watch out for Macduff, that Macduff is dangerous. He already knew that. But that single statement convinces him that Macduff is not only to be watched, but that Macduff is to be killed. He condemns him to death almost instantly. I'll make assurance double sure. In the second place, they tell him that no person born of a woman can overcome him. Now, if you think about that, everybody is born of a woman. So what Macbeth hears is, I can't be killed. They've told him the truth. That's what he reads from it. And the third, that he will never be vanquished until Birnam Wood come to Dunsinane Hill. Who can uproot an entire forest and move it? It's not possible. It's not going to happen. So he believes that he is safe. What he doesn't take into account is how. He doesn't ask any questions. He doesn't say, how could that happen? Or who could that be? He just accepts it on face value. They've told him the truth, but because of his determination that he is invulnerable, he believes exactly what he wants to hear, the most dangerous decision he ever takes. There is a final question he asks. Will Banquo's issue, will Banquo's line ever reign in this kingdom? And the witches show him the most horrific thing possible. King after king after king after king after king, all issuing from Banquo. What they tell him is, no matter what you do, no matter how much you try to change the future, this is going to happen. And to my mind, that's the final thing that tips him over the edge. And he decides if he can't rule the kingdom, if he can't pass on posterity, if he can't control the future, then he will obliterate the present. And he moves from being tyrannical to being genocidal. He wipes out everyone who will stand in his way. And from Collegiate, I want to thank Miriam Pryor, Rachel Brakey, Andrea Graham, and Jason McMahon for reading. Thank you. And now Rosaline Gallagher of Laurel Hill Secondary School, Limerick, is going to give you a sample answer to a question on Macbeth.
I'm going to look at how to answer a question on the role of the witches in Macbeth. There are four key areas that should be discussed. Firstly, how Shakespeare's audience would have viewed the witches as representatives of evil. Secondly, how the witches influence events and advance the plot. Thirdly, how they expose Macbeth's weakness, his fatal flaw. And lastly, how they contribute to the dark and foreboding atmosphere of the play. We may decide to begin by referring to how Shakespeare's audience would have viewed the witches. When the play was first performed in 1606, James I was King of England, and he had written a book about witchcraft called Demonology. While he was King of Scotland, 300 people were accused of being witches and were tortured. Shakespeare's audience would have been well versed in the signs of someone possessed by demons. A trance-like state, actions that were out of character, hallucinations, and the inability to sleep. All of these they would have seen in the character of Macbeth. Therefore, as a modern audience, we should not dismiss the witches as superstitious nonsense. To the people watching the play, they were very real. So in our essay, we should state how Shakespeare intended them to represent evil in the play. Returning then to our second point, we should ask ourselves how the witches advance or influence the plot. We need to find answers to the following. Would Macbeth have murdered Duncan if he had not heard the witch's prophecy, "Thou shalt be king hereafter"? Would he have murdered Banquo had he not heard, "Thou shalt get kings though thou be none"? And would he have murdered Lady Macduff and her family had he not heard, "Macbeth, Macbeth, beware Macduff"? Now you begin to see how many main events in the play can be attributed to the witch's influence. We must therefore decide on the extent of this influence. The witches predict, tempt, and warn Macbeth, but they do not tell him to commit murder. They tell him exactly what he knows or what he desires to hear. They tempt him, but they do not control him. Despite their limited powers, the witches have a strong influence on Macbeth. The impact of the witches and that of Lady Macbeth are major factors in his downfall. We should look to Macbeth's acceptance of the first two predictions to illustrate this. We can describe how he is rapt with all, mesmerised by their predictions, and how he ignores Banquo's warning about the instruments of darkness. Later in Act 4, there is further evidence of their powerful influence. He is foolishly reassured that no man of woman born shall harm him, and that Birnam Wood will not move to Dunsinane Hill. Emboldened by them, Macbeth careers towards his doom. Macbeth has been betrayed in deepest consequence, and his realisation of the true nature of the witches comes too late. In Act 5, Scene 8, Macbeth states, "And be these juggling fiends no more believed that palter us in double sense." This brings us to the third point of the essay. How the witches expose Macbeth's vaulting ambition, his fatal flaw. In this part of the answer, we might explore how the witches set Macbeth a moral challenge, as shown in the soliloquy in Act 1, Scene 3. "My thought, whose murder is yet fantastical, shakes so my single state of man, that function is smothered in surmise, and nothing is but what is not." How temptations are dealt with ultimately depends on a man's character. Macbeth's character is found to be lacking. His vaulting ambition overrides his moral sense, and he ultimately dismisses that horrid image that doth unfix my hair and make my seated heart knock at my ribs against the use of nature. Spurred on by the witch's temptations, he murders Duncan, then Banquo, and later Lady Macduff and her family. An interesting point to include here is how the witch's presence lessens Macbeth's culpability, especially in the first half of the play, and this serves to heighten the tragedy. We can see how the witches prey on the weakness in his character, how they dupe him with honest trifles, Thane of Glamis and Cawdor, and therefore the audience do tend to sympathise with Macbeth because he is charmed by these powerful, malevolent predictions. Finally, then, we turn to the fourth point, how the role of the witches contributes to the overall atmosphere of the play. Here we can discuss Act 1, Scene 1, and Act 4, Scene 1. Both scenes brilliantly illustrate the dark and foreboding atmosphere of the play. The thunder and lightning in Act 1, Scene 1, the fog and filthy air, the desert heath, Grey Malkin and Paddock. In Act 4, Scene 1, we could mention the grotesque nature of the contents of their cauldron, and we could illustrate how their dark powers are shown by the spectacular nature of the apparitions. We could also refer to a stage or film production we have seen, and talk about the effectiveness of these scenes in creating a malevolent and frightening backdrop to the downfall of Macbeth. We need to ask ourselves the question, would the film or stage production have been as interesting or memorable without them? In conclusion, then, we have examined the important and significant role the witches play in Macbeth. Firstly, we discussed how Shakespeare and his contemporaries would have viewed the witches as a real and terrifying threat. Secondly, we illustrated how the witches advance the plot of Macbeth. Thirdly, we have shown how the witches ignite Macbeth's ambition. And lastly, we examined their contribution to the atmosphere of the play and how the play would be less interesting and less appealing without them.
Just as with the first series of prophecies, the action happens almost immediately. Within moments of the demons and the apparitions and the witches vanishing away, Macbeth hears news of Macduff, the man they told him to beware of.
"I did hear the galloping of horse. Who was it came by?"
"'Tis two or three, my lord, that bring you word. Macduff is fled to England." Fled to England?
Aye, my good lord.
Time thou anticipated my dread exploits. This flighty purpose never is overtook, unless the deed go with it. From this moment, the very firstlings of my heart shall be the firstlings of my hand. And even now, to crown my thoughts with acts, be it thought and done, the castle of Macduff I will surprise. Seize upon Fife, give to the edge of the sword his wife, his babes, and all unfortunate souls that trace him in his line. No boasting like a fool. This deed I'll do before this purpose cool, but no more sights.
He decides to act instantly, and because he himself can't reach Macduff, because Macduff has gone to England, he'll destroy everything that Macduff owns. He will have his revenge on Macduff's family. He'll kill his wife, his babes, his servants, his friends. He'll lay waste to Macduff's estate, to all his lands, to anybody that even comes near to Macduff. This is the action of a complete genocidal megalomaniac. Anybody who gets in his way will be destroyed. There's another major change happened in the nature of Macbeth. And thank you to Willa van Niekerk and to William Anderson for reading Ross and Macbeth. It's a great theatrical trick by Shakespeare to use Lady Macduff. He creates a vulnerable character to become the victim of Macbeth's genocide. Macduff has fled to England in the belief that it is a soldierly thing to do. If you can't stay loyal to the king, then you go away and you come back and you fight him. But nobody believes that the families will be affected. Macbeth almost breaks the rule of warfare by attacking families. Lady Macduff is the innocent victim. Ross tries to calm her.
What had he done to make him fly the land?
You must have patience, madam.
He had none. His flight was madness. When our actions do not, our fears do make us traitors.
You know not whether it was his wisdom or his fear.
Wisdom? To leave his wife, to leave his babes, his mansion and his titles in a place from whence himself does fly? He loves us not. He wants the natural touch. For the poor wren, the most diminutive of birds, will fight her young ones in her nest against the owl. All is the fear and nothing is the love. As little is the wisdom where the flight so runs against all reason.
My dearest coz, I pray you, school yourself, but for your husband. He is noble, wise, judicious, and best knows the fits of the season. I dare not speak much further. But cruel are the times when we are traitors, and do not know ourselves when we hold rumour, from what we fear, yet know not what we fear, but float upon a wild and violent sea, each way and move. I take my leave of you. Shall not be long, but I'll be here again. Things at the worst will cease, or else climb upward to what they were before.
Ross is really explaining that the world is in chaos. We don't know what's going to happen. We're getting frightened of our own shadows. We're afraid of rumours. We move upon a wild and violent sea, each way and move. In other words, the tides are taking us in all sorts of different directions, and we don't know what to expect. So what he's saying is, in these circumstances, stay calm. The worst that can happen is that things will stay as they are, and the best is that they'll get better. He's trying to calm her down, to say, don't worry, everything's going to be okay. It's the biggest mistake he makes. Thank you to Nadine Reed and to Willa van Niekerk for reading those two roles.
Hi, I'm Kay Carey, and I'm a student here in Laurel Hill Secondary School in Limerick. My favourite quote is, look like the innocent flower, but be the serpent underneath. This is the advice given in Act 1, Scene 5, to Macbeth by Lady Macbeth before Duncan's murder. This euphemism deals with a major theme in the play. The images used express the idea that false appearance is inseparable from evil. It is undoubtedly the most important image of disguise and concealment used in relation to Macbeth. Macbeth acquires at this point and maintains for a long time the habit of deception. He employs this masking imagery himself. False face must hide what false heart doth know. Macbeth's career is built on this deception. He needs to maintain a false appearance if his scheme is to succeed. This mask doesn't come off until Macbeth decides to take revenge on Macduff, when appearance and reality become one.
My name is Lorcan Blake, and I'm from Belvedere College in Dublin. My favourite quote from the play Macbeth is, I've begun to plant thee, and will labour to make thee full of growing. King Duncan gives us this metaphor of planting while speaking to Macbeth in Act 1, Scene 4. I like this quotation because of its relevance to the character of Macbeth. King Duncan has given him the opportunity to prosper, having appointed him to the positions of both Thane of Cawdor and Thane of Glamis. It is clear that King Duncan has complete confidence in Macbeth. As we will later see, this is pure naivety on King Duncan's part. I admire the fact that this metaphor does not simply stand alone, as it is followed by a corresponding quote from Macbeth. He says, "There if I grow, the harvest is your own." I find this to be a truly ironic response, as later on in the play, Macbeth's growth is of absolutely no benefit to King Duncan.
Again, Shakespeare is very clever. He sets up a scene with a mother and child. Something that's really sympathetic, something that's really nice. The mother and the child having a jokey conversation about the father who's gone away. And when Lady Macduff refers to him as a traitor, it's not a traitor to his country, but a traitor to her. But the scene is domestic. It's lovely. It's warm. And into it comes something from hell.
Yes, he is dead. How wilt thou do for a father?
Nay, how will you do for a husband?
Why, I can buy me 20 at any market.
Then you'll buy him to sell again. Was my father a traitor, mother?
Aye, that he was.
What is a traitor?
Why, one that swears and lies.
And be all traitors that do so?
Everyone that does so is a traitor, and must be hanged.
And must they all be hanged that swear and lie?
Everyone.
Who must hang them?
Why, the honest men.
And into this perfectly delightful domestic scene, something dangerous comes, something out of hell.
Whether should I fly? I have done no harm. But I remember now I am in this earthly world, where to do harm is often laudable, to do good sometime accounted dangerous folly. Why then, alas, do I put up that womanly defence to say I have done no harm? What are these faces?
Where is your husband?
I hope in no place so unsanctified where such as thou must find him.
He's a traitor.
Thou liest, thou shag-haired villain.
What, you egg, young fry of treachery.
Young fry of treachery is a wonderful term being used. Remember that Macbeth has turned the country against itself. People who would not normally go around killing are now killing quite willingly. Young fry of treachery, you're the son of a traitor, therefore you are a traitor, and you will be killed. This is a world in which no one is safe. So let me say thank you to Sarah Woods, to Jade Pollock, and to Alistair Paris from Collegiate for reading those parts. Thank you.
My name is Caroline Harvey. I'm a student here at Greendale Community School, and I have chosen a quote from Act 2, Scene 3. The night has been unruly. Where we lay, our chimneys were blown down, and as they say, lamentings heard in the air, strange screams of death, and prophesying with accents terrible, of dire combustion and confused events. New hatched the woeful time, the obscure board clamoured the livelong night. Some say the earth was feverous and did shake. I chose this quote because the violent and evil images of disease and chaos parallel Macbeth's horrific violation of the natural order and lets readers and audiences know that Macbeth is not the legitimate king. Nature is unleashing her fury and plunging Scotland into darkness, destruction and chaos. This imagery of nature gone AWOL reinforces the idea that Macbeth's violation against moral and lawful authority involves far more than the murder of King Duncan and the seizing of his throne. Macbeth has attacked everything in the world.
I'm Kieran Courtney from the Patrician High School, Carrickmacross, County Monaghan. Oh, full of scorpions is my mind, dear wife. I like this quote because it conveys Macbeth's feelings of guilt and remorse through animal imagery. And it shows you that Macbeth understands that his persona has changed for the worse, and there is nothing he can do to reform.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Kitson, and I go to Castlereagh College in Limerick. This is my favourite quote from Macbeth. Out, out, brief candle, life's but a walking shadow. A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and is then heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. The death of Lady Macbeth, his companion in both prosperity and tragedy, seems to have evoked in Macbeth the darkest emotion of the human condition. He utters these ultimately tragic words in Act 5, Scene 5, upon the realisation that his world is being demolished. Life is a play, an act in which one performs for a judgmental audience and is then forgotten. The departure of Macbeth's lust for life has left him cold, abandoned, and truly susceptible to the effects of desolation. His life has become an inconstant and unsustainable shadow, in certain darkness which will fade with the emergence of light.
So, Macbeth has unleashed this genocide. He sent his murderers out. He's in fact become a mass murderer by proxy. Others are doing it for him, but others are killing whoever he wants, whenever he wants. He doesn't care for his victims, he doesn't mind who he destroys, and he will annihilate anyone and everyone who is in his way. Ross describes Scotland as it now stands. And when you listen to it, it's rather like a contemporary account of Kosovo or Rwanda or anywhere else where mass killings have started to take place.
Alas, poor country, almost afraid to know itself. It cannot be called our mother, but our grave, where sighs and groans and shrieks that rend the air are made, not marked, where violent sorrow seems a modern ecstasy. The dead man's knell is there scarce asked for who, and good men's lives expire before the flowers in their caps, dying or ere they sicken.
That description is absolutely horrific. Where sighs and groans and shrieks that rend the air are made, not marked. Where the amount of pain and agony is so extreme that nobody even sees it anymore. That there are so many bodies lying around the countryside or hanging from gibbets that nobody pays any attention. That the dead man's knell is there, scarce asked for who. There are so many funerals going on, nobody has the time to ask who's dead. In other words, Scotland is now in a state of complete bloody chaos. The action of the play now moves to England. Shakespeare wants to show us where the end of chaos, where the potential for revenge will come from. We're still in a state of genocide. We haven't moved into the next cycle of the play, but Shakespeare is beginning to show us how there will be a conclusion. Malcolm, King Duncan's eldest son and the rightful heir to the crown, has been gathering an army to overthrow Macbeth, and it is to him that Macduff has come. But Malcolm is very, very wary. He's a much cleverer politician than his father was. He knows that when somebody comes to him offering help, it could be a trap from Macbeth. So Malcolm pretends to be as bad as Macbeth is, pretends to be just as much of a tyrant, to test Macduff's loyalty. He wants to see if Macduff is simply an adventurer looking for profit and power, or possibly worse, an agent of Macbeth. Macduff passes the test by refusing to join with Malcolm, and at this point, Malcolm reveals himself as an honourable and decent man.
Macduff, this noble passion, child of integrity, had from my soul wiped the black scruples, reconciled my thoughts to thy good truth and honour. Devilish Macbeth, by many of these trains, had sought to win me into his power.
So he's saying, you're not the first person to come, but the previous ones were all agents of Macbeth.
But God above, deal between thee and me, for even now I put myself to thy direction, and unspeak mine own detraction. Here abjure the taints and blames I laid upon myself. For strangers to my nature, I am yet unknown to woman, never was forsworn, scarcely have coveted what was mine own. At no time broke my faith, would not betray the devil to his fellow, and delight no less in truth than life. What I am truly is thine, and my poor country's to command. Whither indeed, before thy here approach, old seaward with 10,000 warlike men, already at point, was setting forth. Now we'll together, and the chance of goodness be like our warranted quarrel.
Malcolm is sort of offering himself as the great knight in shining armour. He's saying, I am pure, I am decent, I am honest, I am trustworthy, and I've got a huge army ready to go and fight. So you join with me, and we're going to put all this to right. And everything sounds so much better. Shakespeare's offering us the possibility that all's going to be right with the world, and this great army of revenging heroes is going to ride over the border to Scotland and put things to right. And Macduff, for a moment, might be a little bit happier, but only for a moment. It is at this point that Ross arrives with news from Scotland. He tells Malcolm that the country is ready to fight for Malcolm's return.
When I came hither to transport the tidings, which I have heavily borne, there ran a rumour of many worthy fellows that were out, which was to my belief witnessed the rather, for that I saw the tyrant's power afoot. Now is the time of help. Your eye in Scotland would create soldiers, make our women fight, to doff their dire distresses.
Be it their comfort, we are coming thither.
And again, very economically, very simply, Shakespeare says, now's the time. There are many worthy fellows that are out. There are lots of people out beginning to fight a rearguard action against Macbeth. And I can prove by that by the fact that Macbeth soldiers are all over the place trying to put it down. Insurrection is in the air. The women will go and fight for you. Everybody will go and fight for you if only you let them know that you are coming. And Malcolm replies, yes, we are coming. But Ross has worse news to tell concerning Macduff.
Would I could answer this comfort with the like, but I have words that would be howled out in the desert air, where hearing should not latch them.
What concern they? The general cause? Or is it a fee grief due to some single breast?
If it be mine, keep it not from me. Quickly let me have it.
Your castle is surprised, your wife and babes savagely slaughtered, to relate the manner where, on the quarry of these murdered deer, to add the death of you.
Merciful heaven, what man? Give sorrow words. The grief that does not speak whispers the o'er-fraught heart and bids it break.
My children too?
Wife, children, servants, all that could be found.
And I must be from thence. My wife killed too.
I have said.
Be comforted. Let us make us medicines of our great revenge to cure this deadly grief.
He has no children. All my pretty ones. Did you say all? Oh, hellkite, all. What, all my pretty chickens and their dam at one fell sweep?
Now, you'll notice that three times Macduff asks the question, my wife killed, my children killed. Three times he asks that question. And what Shakespeare's doing is making his audience realize just what has happened. Ross has already said, I can't even tell you how they were killed. If you knew it, it would kill you. So what he's saying to the audience, what Shakespeare's saying to the audience is, this is not just slit the throat. This is something utterly gruesome. It is exactly what happened in Rwanda not that long ago when people went out and hacked others to pieces with machetes. This is brutal killing, and this is happening to Macduff's family. Three times he asked the question, three times the answer. All of them dead.
Dispute it like a man.
I shall do so, but I must also feel it as a man. I cannot but remember such things were, that were most precious to me. Did heaven look on, and would not take their part? Sinful Macduff, they were all struck for thee. Not that I am, not for their own demerits, but for mine. Fell slaughter on their souls. Heaven rest them now.
Be this the whetstone of your sword. Let greed convert to anger. Blunt not the heart. Enrage it.
It's very clever here. Malcolm is proving himself to be, yet again, a very astute politician. At the moment of Macduff's greatest grief, he says, use that anger. Turn it into anger. He's, in fact, turning Macduff into a weapon with which he, Malcolm, can begin to fight Macbeth.
Oh, I could play the woman with mine eyes and braggart with my tongue, but gentle heavens, cut short all intermission. Front to front, bring thou this fiend of Scotland and myself. Within my sword's length, set him. If he scape, heaven forgive him too.
This tune goes manly. Come, our power is ready. Our lack is nothing but our leave. Macbeth is ripe for shaking, and the powers above put on their instruments. Receive what cheer you may. The night is long that never finds the day.
The night is long that never finds the day. What Shakespeare again here is saying, it's been black, it's got blacker, it's got to the very, very worst. But no matter how long the night, no matter how dark the night, the dawn will come. And so they leave to bring the final part of the prophecy to its conclusion. They are ready now to march to Burnham. And thank you to Patrick Moyner as Macduff, to Micheál McConnell as Ross, and to Daryl Caplice as Malcolm, all from Patrician. And now Vincent Lee of St. McCartan's College, Monaghan, is going to give you a sample answer to a question on Macbeth.
The question I'm going to talk about is how Shakespeare uses imagery in Macbeth to express, develop, and illustrate his themes. For example, he uses images of darkness and storm, images of clothing. Now does he feel his title hang loose about him like a giant's robe upon a dwarfish thief. Animal images appear frequently in the play too. Duncan's horses turned wild in nature, broke their stalls. The natural order is breaking down. But it is images of blood that dominate the play from first scene to last. I will talk about images of blood under six headings. First of all, blood as a physical entity in the play. Then blood as a symbol of the subversion of the norm. Thirdly, blood as a symbol of guilt. And then blood images reconfigured to symbolise the internal drama of the play. Fifthly, blood as a symbol of royal virtue. And then blood as a symbol of Macbeth's predicament at a pivotal moment in the play. Now, blood as a physical entity in the play. In the opening scenes of the play, blood is evident as a physical presence that is talked about and witnessed. Duncan's first question is, what bloody man is that? We hear of brave Macbeth, whose sword smoked with bloody execution. A sergeant tells of reeking wounds as his own gashes cry for help. The opening scenes are swimming in human blood. Macbeth and Banquo cut swathes through the ranks of their enemies and win the favour of their king and countrymen. While the generals are undoubtedly motivated by their fervent patriotism, nevertheless, it appears that they have been taken over by some form of bloodlust. So fond are they of dismembering the bodies of their fallen enemies. In the second paragraph, we see blood as a symbol of a subversion of the norm. As she awaits the return of her husband from battle, Lady Macbeth prays to evil spirits that they may eradicate all feminine traits of gentleness and pity from her nature. Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here, and fill me from the crown to the toe top full of direst cruelty. Make thick my blood. This represents a subversion of the norm, where we would expect Lady Macbeth to harbour nurturing thoughts aimed at sustaining life rather than destroying it. The blood motif which she draws upon illustrates the tremendous force of will that pulsed through her. And then in the third paragraph, we'll discuss blood as a symbol of guilt. While the letting of blood was apparently the norm for Macbeth in battle, it is ironic that he shudders physically after he had witnessed the king's lifeblood ebb away. This is a sorry sight. His murderous hands are now these hangman's hands, which he fears will incarnadine or make red all great Neptune's ocean. Blood is now an awful symbol of guilt for Macbeth, the murderer. Another great irony of the play is that Lady Macbeth has apparently no fear of blood at the time of Duncan's murder and scorns her husband's cowardice for not going back to smear the grooms with it. A little water clears us of this deed, she declares. My hands are of your colour, but I shame to wear a heart so white. Yet when we meet her in Act 5, she has become a mental wreck as she tries to remove the imaginary spots of blood from her hands. Out, damned spot, out, I say. Her mind is now obsessed with her vision of blood. Who would have thought the old man to have had so much blood in him? The images of blood have now risen to haunt her and ultimately drive her to her death. And then we see how blood images are reconfigured to symbolise the internal drama of the play. It is of much significance in the play that as Macbeth sinks into the depravity of regicide, blood images are reconfigured to occupy the interior spaces of the play. By that I mean that they become part of the drama going on within Macbeth's mind. As he contemplates the murder of Duncan, he hallucinates about a dagger which hovers in the air before him. He wonders, is it real, or if it is the bloody business which informs thus to mine eyes? But one thing is clear as the dagger materialises more vividly before him. Gouts of blood decorate its handle, the blood of Duncan that he is about to shed. His guilt has already begun to seep into his mind. And this mental drama continues when the ghost of the murdered Banquo comes to terrify him at the banquet. Never shake your gory locks at me, he commands. These images of blood are so vividly realised in the mind of Macbeth that they become almost visible to the audience too. It will have blood, they say. Blood will have blood, is Macbeth's horrified conclusion as his banquet ends in chaos and his guests beat a hasty retreat. But then blood is seen as a symbol of royal virtue in the play also. Having rushed to the murder chamber and killed the sleeping grooms, he returns and explains his actions to the shocked gathering. Here lay Duncan, his silver skin laced with his golden blood, and his gashed stabs looked like a breach in nature. There the murderers, steeped in the colours of their trade, their daggers unmannerly breached with gore. Who could refrain that had a heart to love? The red blood of guilt had become the golden blood of the virtuous king. And in this moment, Shakespeare has managed to encapsulate the essential drama of the play, the deviation from virtue to vice. Blood is also seen as a symbol of Macbeth's predicament at the pivotal moment in the play. At the end of the banquet scene, Macbeth arrives at a pivotal moment in his life. This occurs when he realizes for the first time the extent of his own predicament. He has murdered the king. He has had Banquo assassinated. Where does he go from here? He comes to the conclusion that he must continue on the same path of murder as before. I am in blood stepped in so far that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as go o'er. By Act 5, the Wheel of Fortune has turned and brought the tyrant to his knees. What a pity for him that he hadn't taken heed of his own warning, which he had issued before he murdered Duncan. We but teach bloody instructions, which being taught return to plague the inventor. So we have seen blood used throughout the play as a physical entity, as a symbol of the subversion of what is normal, as a symbol of guilt, as a symbol of the internal drama of the play, as a symbol of royal virtue, and as a symbol of Macbeth's essential predicament in the play. And in conclusion then, it is no wonder that with the predominance of the blood motif throughout the play, Shakespeare decides to end it with one more gruesome bloody picture. In Act 5, Scene 8, Macduff appears on the battlefield, holding aloft the severed head of Macbeth. The wheel has come full circle. The usurper's cursed head will no doubt decorate the battlements of the victor's castle, just as Macdonald's had in Act 1. The bloody instructions have indeed returned to plague the inventor.
So, with Malcolm and Macduff and Siward's army on the way to Scotland, we return there. We return to Burnham. We return to Macbeth's castle to meet the final victim of the genocide. And for Macbeth, it would be the most unexpected. It is his wife. His wife has also lost the ability to sleep in comfort. In a very brief scene, we see a doctor and a servant watch her as she walks in her sleep, night after night, confessing the crimes of herself and her husband.
I have 2 nights' watch with you, but can perceive no truth in your report. When was it she last walked?
Since His Majesty went into the field, I have seen her rise from her bed, throw her nightgown upon her, unlock her closet, take forth paper, fold it, write upon it, read it, afterwards seal it, and again return to bed. Yet all this while in a fast sleep.
And then the sleepwalking Lady Macbeth enters.
Lo you, here she comes.
You see, her eyes are open.
Aye, but their sense are shut.
What is it she does now? Look how she rubs her hands.
It is an accustomed action with her, to seem thus washing her hands. I have known her to continue in this a quarter of an hour.
Now let's remember that when Macbeth murdered Duncan, Lady Macbeth said, quite easily, a little water washes this blood from our hands. It's not a problem. We can just wash it off. Now things have changed.
Yet here's a spot. Out, damned spot, out, I say. 1, 2. Why then, 'tis time to do it. Hell is murky. Fie, my lord, fie. A soldier and afeard. What need we fear who knows it, when none can call our power to account? Yet who would have thought the old man to have so much blood in him?
Do you mark that?
The Thane of Fife had a wife. Where is she now?
Even the death of Lady Macduff is preying on her mind.
What, will these hands ne'er be clean?
The blood won't wash off in her mind.
No more of that, my lord, no more of that. You mar all with this starting.
Go to, you have known what you should not.
She has spoke what she should not, I am sure of that. Heaven knows what she has known.
Here's the smell of the blood still. All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand. Oh,
what a sigh is there. The heart is sorely charged.
I would not have such a heart in my bosom for the dignity of the whole body.
This disease is beyond my practice.
Wash your hands. Put on your nightgown. Look not so pale. I tell you yet again, Banquo's buried. He cannot come out on's grave.
Even so.
To bed, to bed. There's knocking at the gate. Come, 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 come. Give me your hand. What's done cannot be undone. To bed, to bed, to bed.
And in her sleep, night after night, she relives, she reenacts the deeds that they have done. She reenacts the murder of Duncan. She reenacts the murder of Banquo. She is completely and utterly haunted, just as her husband is. She will never sleep comfortably again.
Foul whisperings are abroad. Unnatural deeds do breed unnatural troubles. Infected minds to their death pillows will discharge their secrets. More need she the divine than the physician. God, God, forgive us all.
God forgive us all is the last words that the doctor says. And it's a prayer that is quite genuine, because Macbeth got away with it because he was allowed to, because everybody else became involved in it. Those who stayed and who worked and continued under him were as much guilty of what he did as he was, because without them, he could not have done it. Without Lady Macbeth, he could not have done it. And she now has become the victim of her husband's vaulting ambition. She is the genocide's final victim. And thank you to Emma Hazlitt as the Doctor, Vicky Sloane as the Gentlewoman, and Sarah Hall as Lady Macbeth, and all from Collegiate. And for today's quiz from St. Louis, we have
Caroline Kieran.
From Patrician, we have
Raymond Martin.
From Collegiate,
Vicky Sloane.
And from St. McCartan's,
Brendan McArdle.
And off we go. A question for each of you. First, Caroline. Who says, well may you see things well done there, adieu, lest our old robe sit easier than our new?
Titus.
It's Macduff. Raymond, who says, to be thus is nothing, but to be safely thus?
Macbeth.
Correct. Vicky, who says, stand not upon the order of your going, but go at once?
Lady Macbeth.
Correct. And Brendan, who says, and you all know security is mortal's chiefest enemy?
Hecate.
Hecate is correct. Now, here we have the recorded round. I want you to listen to the recording, and I'll ask you each a question. First of all, Caroline, here's yours.
There's no art to find the mind's construction in the face. He was a gentleman on whom I built an absolute trust.
The Thane of Corder.
Speaking?
Duncan.
Duncan speaking concerning the Thane of Corder. Yes, I'll accept that. 2 points. Now, Raymond, here's yours.
Oh, horror! 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 Tongue nor heart cannot conceive nor name thee.
What's the matter?
Confusion now hath made its masterpiece. Most sacrilegious murder hath broke open the Lord's anointed temple and stole thence the life of the building.
Now, who's speaking to who?
Macduff to Ross.
I give you 1 point for that. It's Macduff to Macbeth. And now, Vicky, here's yours.
Pray you, let not my jealousies be your dishonours, but mine own safeties. You may be rightly just, whatever I shall think.
Bleed, bleed, poor country. Great tyranny, lay thou thy basis sure, for goodness dare not check thee. Wear thou thy wrongs, the title is afeard. Fare thee well, Lord.
So who are the two people speaking there?
Macduff and Ross.
1 point. It's Macduff and Malcolm. And now, Brendan.
Tan! Of all men else, I have avoided thee. But get thee back. My soul is too much charged with blood of thine already.
I have no words. My voice is in my sword. Thou bloodier villain than terms can give thee out.
Macduff and Macbeth.
That's correct. Well done. 2 points. And now we move on to the quickfire round, so fingers on your buzzers, and here we go. Which nobleman does not attend Macbeth's banquet? That's Caroline.
Macduff.
Macduff, correct. Are the murderers successful in their attempt to kill Banquo and Fleance? Raymond.
No, Fleance escapes.
Well done. Why does Lennox think Banquo was killed?
Because he rode too late.
That was Caroline, and she's correct. Who does Lennox think killed Banquo? And that's Brendan.
Fleance.
Well done. Why does Lennox think Fleance murdered Banquo? That's Brendan again.
Because he fled the scene.
Well done. Whose appearance at the banquet upset Macbeth? That's Caroline.
Banquo's ghost.
Well done. Why is Hecate angry with the three witches? Okay, Caroline?
Because the witches didn't consult her in their plans.
That's right. Why has Macduff gone to the English court? And that's Vicky.
To get an English army.
Well done. Where is Macduff's castle? Caroline.
Fife.
Well done. What does Hecate tell the witches to do to enchant the ingredients of the cauldron? And Brendan?
To dance around it.
Well done. How many apparitions are conjured up? That's Raymond.
Three.
Three is correct. What does the first apparition tell Macbeth? Caroline?
Beware Macduff, the Thane of Fife.
Well done. What does the second one say? That's Raymond.
That none of women born shall harm Macbeth.
Well done. When Macbeth asks the witches if Banquo's issues shall reign, how many kings are revealed? Vicky?
Eight.
Eight is correct. Well done. And the results of that give Collegiate 5 points, Patrician 6 points, and joint winners are St. McCartan's and St. Louis on 8 points. So, don't be too eager. We're going to have a tiebreaker. So this is just... This is just for Caroline and Brendan. What does Lady Macbeth plan to do to Duncan's chamberlains? And it was Brendan.
Drug them.
That's correct, to drug their drink. So I therefore declare St. McCartan's the winner. Our production crew today was Kevin Reynolds, Catherine Brennan, Sean Rocks, and Orla Cotter, with Tony Lyons on sound. And I'm Alan Stamford of Second Age Theatre Company. Join us again next week when we'll be examining the revenge in Macbeth.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/radio1.